My name is Norma Jean Strumman, and the title of this session is Living with What We Cannot Fix. I don't know how many of you were here on Monday. Quite a few. Some of you were, some weren't. Just a very quick review of what I did on Monday was to introduce this whole series. Each session will be self-contained, and yet each will build on the other one. One of my grieving issues is that this village's bulb broke for the overhead projector, so I can't use all my wonderful transparencies, and I really rely heavily on them, so I'm going to be missing those. But the session on Monday was entitled Treasure in Earthen Vessels, Embracing the Contraries, and I think this is worth repeating. I teach in images and symbols, and I think that way, and I learn that way, and this is a Holden mug that we bought here. Last year I bought it for my husband, actually, and I really just like to drink coffee out of it, and something broke it, and I couldn't even repair it with cement glue, so it remains broken. And this is one of my metaphors, ongoing metaphors for the class and for our discussion, which is that we are really broken treasures, which is a contrary in itself, but that's what we are, broken into by life, and yet we are treasures for many reasons. And embracing the contraries basically is just the whole idea that of today's topic, that to find life mysteriously, we need to fully embrace death, as opposed to stuffing it, or in some way trying to just get away with, do away with it without having to deal with it. This is a little preview for tomorrow. I don't think you can even see it. Tomorrow's session I'm going to be doing on grief, unresolved grief in blended families, and my image being of the circle, and ties in again with today's topic on living with what we cannot fix. Because any relationship, starting with a one person being a whole person, is a circle to me. And then in marriage or a friendship relationship or whatever kind of relationship you have, those two or more people come together in some kind of a bond, which is a circle. And once that is broken into in whatever way, but in my classes I'm talking about being broken into by death, there is a rip in the circle. And this is a picture that my friend Nancy drew of her family, now a blended family, which she married a man who had three children, and his wife also died of cancer, as did Nancy's husband, and this is how she draws their family. So I think you could title this Living with What We Cannot Fix, or Unresolved Issues in Broken Families. So that's just a little preview for tomorrow. I mentioned on Monday the grief support groups that I do back in my hometown. And for those of you that might be interested, I have some brochures up here. My word is shalom. I make shalom greeting cards. And I decided to title this whole support group thing a shalom group. And down here I did a little play on words, which I also would have had on the overhead, which just simply says that stories shared heal lives, empower us, and move us on. And the title, obviously, we can't fix what is broken. A lot of what we have to live with in this life that is broken in us, we just have to live with. But I really believe, with one thesis of my topics is certainly the healing power of community. One woman I talked to at the end of the session on Monday said, what do you do with grief that never ends, i.e. a child who has a mental illness? And I'm sure if we started telling stories here this morning, we could all tell stories of certain kinds of grief that never end all through life. Okay. In a way of review, what I'd just like to lift up as themes for those of you that weren't here on Monday that I'm dealing with is the whole contrary of individual within community, broken and whole at the same time, life and death, entering into pain to heal it, that pain leads us to our bliss, and that will be the focus of my sessions next week, that we get energy from staying in conversation with people in pain, and that when we are in community as individuals, we are no longer just one, but we are two, three, and four. We are individual and more than one. And the whole theme of finding our voice in the midst of community. I'd like to highlight some of Peter Steinke's themes, too. I've been hearing themes in every session I've gone to that relate to my work. One of them he mentioned the other day is that we get sick over things we can't talk about in our families. which is one reason I believe so much in the process of community, i.e. groups. In this case, having a group to talk about our losses and griefs. He also mentioned that in the creation story, there was no order until God asked Adam to name the creatures. And I find that very true in my own life, and I find it true with people I work with, that when we can name what's hurting us, then we can start to deal with it. And that's part of the process of group. And today, those of you who didn't get to see the video, I promise I'm going to show it before I run out of time today, but Barbara, the one who I'm going to show today, talks a lot about the power of naming that she has found through being in a group with other people who help you name your own pain. Peter Steinke also talked about how touching is crucial for the psychological birth of human beings. Touching is also very crucial for healing in grief, and that the real self has to be able to have permission to have your own feelings and to express them. And so it is with grief. And this is one of my issues with the church. I mentioned on Monday that what gives me my bliss in doing this kind of work is I believe it's the church in the world. And ironically, I find this true myself. Many people find more freedom to talk about this in a funeral home setting than they do in the church, and ideally the church should be set up for this. There are a lot of reasons for that, I think. But to be able to sit in a group and have time to tell different kinds of stories and reprocess them in the light of other people's stories is to be able to get in touch with your real self. And over again, people will talk about how they don't have that freedom in their own families sometimes, or in their own marriages, or with their best friends sometimes. So that's another one of the reasons I think it's so important. And finally, Peter Steinke also talked about the importance of image in learning and how we have images printed on our reptilian brains that we're still operating out of. And that is one of the reasons I use image a lot in my teaching and in my group work. This is an image. And for those of you that weren't here on Monday, this is basically how I use image in teaching, is I carry around a little suitcase with me every time I teach. But I have a woven placemat, actually, that is the center point. And then I told the story on Monday about how this is one of my images, the circle, five people in my original family, five now. I won't repeat that because I talked about that on Monday. But this is a symbol of a family unit that has, in my case, was broken into by two cancer deaths early in my life. So I talked about having mended points on my circle, or patches of healing, rather than that they went away and I got over all this or something like that in a year, which is what a lot of people say. And then I do a lot of work with candles and centerpieces and that kind of thing. And then I didn't take time or have time to do this on Monday, but I'd like to show you some of the ways I think it's a real powerful way to use this in your home, if you teach Sunday school, any kind of teaching or working with groups. Since I design greeting cards and I love to use them, I collect them. I have three drawers full of greeting cards at home that I use for different things and have on hand. So here is what I will oftentimes do if I don't have this as the center point. I will just pick a card and maybe have one simple thing or two that have a theme. And this is, for instance, a series of pictures and cards that to me depict community, the beauty of community. Dietrich Bonhoeffer is one of my favorite teachers, and some of you may have read his little book, Life Together. And he talks about the physical presence of healing community, and how Jesus was born in a baby's body. He grew up in a little boy's body. He was crucified in the body. We believe he rose in the physical body, and we too will have someday a new body. And that just leaped off the page at me, because I think that one of the crucial things in healing grief work, I know this has been true in my life, and when I work with others, they say it over and over, that there really isn't a lot we can say to one another in terms of words that will take away pain or even alleviate it at some points, but our physical presence is crucial. I remember my friend Linda, who came when my brother died, and Linda would never have known what to say, but I still remember the color of a casserole she handed me, and that we stood and wept together. And I hear stories over and over of people who remember who came, and you remember that they were there. You don't remember much of what they said. So like I'll just put a picture like this, or I mentioned this on Monday, Tommy DiPolo's artwork of the feast, the gathering of the feast and God's reign And it is amazing what images this evokes in people in the group. When sometimes I will highlight at the very beginning of the session or somewhere in the session, and I just collect things. Like this is just a little postcard from my Irish friend who wrote the poem on Monday. It's a wonderful pottery mug and teapot and Irish bread and butter. And when she sent me this card, this is Maureen. This is just who she is. It reminds me of my friendship with her. And that reminds me of community in terms of friendship. And, you know, whatever. These are just pictures of the beauty of Christian friendship. So that is one kind of way I can use them. The other one is like, here is a series, these are Abbey Press cards, of life out of death, of the crocus coming up out of ice, or of the butterfly. And so if our theme is resurrection and new life or something like that, just this, and then we can burn candles in my funeral. I can't burn them out here, which is too bad because I love to burn candles, but just to have a candle lit. And that is the focus of people's meditation, and those images are evoking stories in people's minds and hearts and memories during the group time. So this is all in the power of image. And then this is another series on brokenness, which kind of gets to at today's theme. This is one of my very favorite cards, and I'll just read this one from Abbey Press. It says, God uses broken things. It takes broken soil to produce a crop, broken clouds to give rain, broken grain to give bread, and broken bread to give strength. And that's the irony, that we are healed out of our brokenness because of our brokenness, and we are, I think, more effective healers the more we have been broken into and the more we have known God's healing. This is another one of my favorite cards by Rilke, who talks about living the questions now, and I'm going to read this one too. Be patient toward all that is unsolved in your heart. Try to love the questions themselves, like locked rooms and like books written in a very foreign tongue. Do not now seek the answers which cannot be given you, because you would not be able to live them. Perhaps you will then gradually, without noticing it, live along some distant day into the answer. It's the whole thing of living the questions. We want answers, but we oftentimes don't get them. And this is a card, and 5 years ago I designed a series that looked like this. And this is a story, a really important story in my own life. I've known this verse from Romans 8:26 all of my life, but it came at a point when my brother was dying in University of Minnesota Hospital, and our family had been summoned, if we weren't there, which we usually were, several times toward the end, and they thought that that would be the night, and this turned out to be one of those times, and we had roared down to Minneapolis, and as it turned out, he was rallying again. And it was one of those times when my best friend from high school, one of my good friends, I should say, had just been killed in Vietnam. And I was working in this nursing home at my hometown where people wished they would have died many years ago. And my brother was dying, and I was inundated with death everywhere. And I was standing at the end of the hall kicking the radiators. I remember I wore a red jumper. I remember everything about it. And my aunt came in and took me into her arms, and I was weeping and kind of like at the end of my rope, and she read this verse to me, or gave it, she knew it by heart. She said, the Spirit helps us in our weakness, for we do not know how to pray as we ought, but the Spirit intercedes for us with sighs too deep for words, which has become my praying mantra for really everything ever since. And that, I think, is crucial to this whole topic of living with what we cannot fix, because even when we have come to the end of our resources, God's Spirit is somehow praying for us in the midst of all that. Okay, that's just a little bit on images. I'd like to tell you a story, another story from my daughter's life, our life, that I think illustrates this idea of living with what we cannot fix. When we moved to Duluth, where we now live, from our other town, 5.5 years ago, the woman in our church who befriended me, and I felt like she was an old friend after only a couple weeks, was killed in a car accident 6 weeks after we moved there. And up until that time, her daughter looked like my daughter's twin. And every Friday, for only 6 weeks, we did this in the middle of a horribly cold winter. Neither one of us was employed at the time, so I would take her daughter one Friday and she'd have the day off and vice versa. And our daughters became very close, and so did we. And on President's holiday in February, she was tragically killed, and it was a tremendously scarring situation for my daughter, because at only age 4 and a half, we had just moved, we had given up, by the way, moving for me is a 3-year grieving process. It's also wonderful, but everything, you have to reinvent the wheel, and you have to make new friends, you have to find a new dentist, etc. So we really didn't know anybody, and so I think in her mind, as a child would of course think, well, if her mommy died, maybe my mommy will get snatched away just like that. And we walked through that. We went to the funeral. I mean, we talked about it. We talk about where people go when they die. You know, you do the best thing you can as a parent, and it isn't like we said, well, we can't talk about that now. We were very open about everything. But I knew that underneath that was an ongoing scar. Well, then 3 years ago, we were on vacation when my husband's youngest brother was killed very suddenly by a bolt of lightning in the middle of a beautiful day after a storm had just blown over. And again, another trauma for a young child to have had two close people to her just snatched away by sudden death. I think if there's cancer or lingering illness, at least you have some time to talk and grieve before it happens. Well, the reason I'm telling this story is because my daughter is a very happy-go-lucky, buoyant personality. She sings a lot, and yet after David died, and I noticed something was happening to her, and that was that she, in the middle of her play or at dinner or wherever, all of a sudden she might just go like this or just start to cry, and then she would say things like, I sure hope I can die before you, Mom, and just, and as a parent you're going, oh no, and many tears at bedtime and couldn't go to sleep at night and was crying a lot, and so we did the best we could, and one day in the middle of a summer afternoon she flopped down on our stairway in the hall, in the front hall, and she said, Mom, isn't there a doctor that I can see that could just give me a pill and take this away from me? And this is when she was 8 years old. And I said, no, there isn't. That no one can do that. Medicine can't do that either. And but I said, you know, we've talked, Annalise. I've told you all I know how to say. And this has been an ongoing in and out conversation. And I said, there are counselors that you can talk to, and in our town we have a wonderful man named Ben Wolf who started a grief support center, and he has children's groups. And I said, you could go to that if you'd like. There are other children who have had losses. Some have lost a mom or a dad or brother or sister or grandmas. And she said, is he the best in town? And I said, I think he is. And so his method is to have the child call him, so they're taking ownership in this whole situation. And she went to the group, and the first time I picked her up after the group, it was an 8-session thing, I think. And I said, well, how'd it go? She says, well, I'm afraid I won't be able to tell you anything because everything in the group is highly confidential. Which is wonderful therapy in itself. And so I didn't ask her another thing until, like, the next to the last session, they visited an embalming room of a funeral home, and then she couldn't stop talking about, she was relating everything to Uncle Dave. She said, you know how what they do with their eyes? She says, that's what they did to Uncle Dave, and on through Uncle Dave. And then, not long ago, this is 2 years after her group experience now, or a year and a half, her little cousin who lives in Rochester, Minnesota, was going through some separation anxiety fears with her own mother caused by the death in some in the town. And my sister called me and said, how did Annalise get through this? Maybe she can help my daughter. They're only 4 months apart. So I told Annalise that, and I said, you know, maybe you could call Anna and tell her about the group you were in or write her a letter. She said, that group didn't help me. And I said, it didn't. I thought this was just a wonderful group for her. And she says, no. And I said, well, I always thought that group was really helpful to you. And she said, well, that isn't it at all, Mom. She says, you know what it was? She said, see, sometimes I jog around our neighborhood. I don't go at dark, but sometimes I go too close to dark for her. And little children don't like their parents to be out at night, especially a woman, I guess, jogging around. So she said, well, you know, one night when you were jogging and I didn't like it, I just decided I had to do something about this. So I came up with this, that I just pretend that everybody that's a Christian and everybody that I love is walking around with a big glass block around them, and they're safe and they're protected and they're not going to get hurt. And that, to her, was what helped her, not the group. So I tell that story because that has a lot to do with imagery. I think a little child, like Jesus said, a little child can lead them. Her image of a glass block that is protecting me and everybody she loved, as a matter of fact, the group helped her tremendously. And But she didn't want to tell this to her cousin that. She says, Mother, this is my private secret. I do not want you to tell anybody. So I think I'll write a children's book about it someday anyway. But children, too, deal with tremendous losses and things they cannot fix and cannot understand and have different developmental stages than we do. And sometimes children can really help us understand what we cannot fix. I meant to read this at the very close of the Monday session, and I didn't have time because they were stampeding through that room. So I'd like to read it now. One of my favorite magazines is The Other Side, and some of you don't get it. It's up here in the library. And in the July issue, August issue, there was this poem, and I thought, this is, to me, really sets on edge this idea of contraries and embracing the contraries. It's written by a woman named Judith Emlyn Johnson, and it's called In the Opening Night Sky. Love, we are all born out of this holding darkness. Into our lives down a bloody current and against our wills, we rejoice in the light. We are grateful to breathe. The air fills our lungs and the light fills our eyes. The tenderness of earth fills our skins, the gladness of touch, and we swell with it. We give birth to ourselves through the world of sense. Full of ourselves, we never see that what we hold inside is that darkness which nourished us before we knew our minds. When we feel the rich undersea cave awash with our salts, we grow afraid. We pull back. We hate entering again to find that life out of which we broke with such struggle. And although when the wave lifts us and slams us inward, we ride, jelly and weed inhabiting our pores, our eyes, our lungs, we dread good Mother Night, who bore us and whom we bear. I think that says a lot about the darkness out of which we come, the light that we embrace, and then having to go back again into the darkness that we bear within us and that bears us. And so we live in this incredible tension, I think, between the light and the dark. Briefly on Monday, I mentioned some of my teachers, who have a lot to say to us about the tensions we're talking about. One of them being black women writers. I'm not going to repeat all these because I talked about it Monday. The Woman at the Well, The Unnamed Woman. I've mentioned Dietrich Bonhoeffer. Another one of his themes is that in the book Life Together is that community is the greatest gift we can have, but it's also the most difficult to achieve. And Martin Marty has written a book called The Cry of Absence, and Bonhoeffer in this book also talks about absence being a call to presence. And those of you that have been in the darkness of a loss know what that means, that when someone is present with you, it makes all the difference. And another one of his themes is that we are asked to walk in comfort with those who don't, which is one of the themes of being a broken treasure. And then I'd like to repeat that Elie Wiesel quote, which is one of my favorites from all of his writings. He says, I'll transmit my experience to you, and you in turn will be compelled to do the same. You in turn will become a messenger, and once a messenger, you have no alternative. To me, that translates into whatever story we have, whatever our stories are of brokenness and pain and loss and healing, that has shaped us into be different people, and we have a message to tell. Matthew Fox's original blessing, I'm going to be talking about that in a couple of the other sessions, too, has really profoundly influenced me. He has a whole theme in that book that we enter into pain in order to let go of it, not to hang on to it and nurture it, but to enter into it, to name it so that it can be released. And my image of that is like a beach ball. You know, if it's there in front of you, there it is. And you know, if you try to keep it under the water, you're spending all your energy doing that instead of just beholding it and dealing with it and finding out what to do with it so that it can go off away. Another quick story about a woman in Duluth who I was referred to by a woman who said, I think this woman has a lot to say, and it's quite a story, and I'm going to tell it just because of the point of the story. This is now an 83-year-old woman who was in Germany at the time of the war, had four children. One of them died in the death camps because they were captured by the Nazis, and one died of an illness. And then they were sponsored as war refugees in Duluth, came and Her husband died of a heart attack at age 39, and she was left with two children in a new land and had to re-educate. She couldn't get a job to make money, whereas in Germany she had a very well-paying job, and just in all that incredible kind of anguish. And her point, though, was that when they came to the church, the people accepted them and supported them as refugees, and then really no one befriended her, and she was very much alone. And so she remembers the fruit basket coming at Christmas, and she was realized she was very full of resentment about this fruit basket, and realized it was because no one was willing to be her friend. Why should she get a fruit basket? Who cares? And so 40 years later, she happened to be talking to a women's group and said, you know, why did no one come to be my friend, and why was I left so alone? And their basic answer was, because we didn't know what to say. And I thought the truth of that story is very poignant, because over and over again, dealing with people who are on the other side of tragedy, tragedies happen in the town, and you know you should reach out to that person, but we don't know what to say, and it's not something we talk about easily or casually. And if we don't have a place to talk about it, we don't say anything. And so the worst thing that can happen is isolation and not to say anything at all, because people feel very abandoned by that. At this point, I'm going to show the video from, her name is Barb Gaddy. She told me I could tell you her name and everything, gave me permission to show it. These are like half hour videos I'm doing, and I just edited out a little piece. Basically, her situation is that she's like in her late 30s. And she came into the group to deal with some unresolved grief that she had stuffed for 10 years. She was divorced, and right after she was divorced, her father died, and she realized 10 years later that she'd never dealt with it. And she's got a really good piece on spirituality at the beginning that I'm not going to take time to show, because the middle piece is what I want to show the most. But in the groups that I do, one of the things that I very intentionally invite people to deal with is their spirituality, i.e., what the meaning of their loss is. And one of the things she said is that was the most important thing to her about being in the group, that it was a comfortable place to share, and that her notion of spirituality in a group like this is that you didn't have to solve anything. She's been in some counseling in her life and in a lot of different kinds of groups, and that the confidentiality and trust of the group is what really invited her in to share her story. The other thing I should tell you about her is that how this happened for her, and we were talking, you know, about being a broken treasure. She was at a party, a social event in our town, and one of the guys who I work for was at that party and came over and put his arm around her at a Christmas party. He said, "How are you doing, Barb?" And she said, "Horrible," and she burst into tears and realized that Christmas and all the environment, moving back to Duluth, which is another long part of her story, had evoked, and again, that's kind of image and environment, it evoked in her a lot of the stuff that she realized she'd never dealt with. So, we'll just, this is about 5 minutes up here, you'll just have to turn around and see what she's got to say.
I have tremendous good feelings about being out there, but after I had been there for a while, and I was there 8 years, even though I left an anchor of support there, it was real necessary for me to get back to, it wasn't real necessary, but when the opportunity came for my husband to transfer back here, it wasn't even an issue between either one of us, it was just that we were both going to come back home. But I would have not been able to come back here, I don't think, previous to that, because I didn't have my other issues healed up enough to come back and face. It's really funny, when I was, my husband and I had already moved to Duluth, and I had a bunch of girlfriends that we played tennis with and hiked and camped with and stuff, and they'd go away for it. And we were at a restaurant in downtown Rapid City, and it was a really warm night. And at about 10:30 at night, I was saying goodbye to him, and all of a sudden I started to cry, which is kind of unusual for myself. And they looked at me, and one of the girls said, "What's wrong?" I said, "I'm going back to my past." I said, "And I don't know what this means, but I know I'm going back to my past." And it was real scary for me. And I'm sure it was because I knew that I had this huge grief issue that I had to deal with.
Could you speak a little bit to how the group has helped you deal with that, those issues? You've only been in a few months.
Yeah. Well, I thought about that, and I think that God worked his way with me wonderfully, because I walked into a group where there was so many more things that had happened to people than I had gone through. And there were also the things that I feared. There was a couple in there who had lost their daughter to suicide. I had always thought about that. I had thought, what if a child would commit suicide? I was definitely afraid of that. They're dealing with it and watching them get stronger. And the tears that I cried with them and for them and for the other people in the group, another lady who was widowed, and I listened to her talk, and I hear my mother talking, but so I'm going through the grief that my mother had such a hard time going through with this lady in the group, and again, the tears that I cry with them. Just all the tears of everybody else, which are so awful. Kathy's brother dying in such an awful way. I think of my family, which is close like Kathy's family, and how that would have been just horrifying to me. So it helped to get into this group and hear these, what could be termed as awful stories, to cry the tears with these people, and then to watch the people get stronger, and then to realize that everybody's grief issue is real true grief, and mine was grief too, but it helped to deal with all these different issues.
Gave
me perspective, and it also gave me tremendous strength. When I had first moved here, I realized that I hadn't been through all of life that I was going to go through, and it scared the hell out of me to think about the fact that just a divorce and just my dad dying wasn't it. So that, as I have sat in this grief support group and watched everybody deal with these issues, I have become stronger in realizing that when the next bout of grief hits me, however it might be, I know that I'm going to be able to handle it, just because I've watched other people handle other kinds of grief than what I went through.
Mm-hmm. Anything else you'd like to share about the process of the group in addition to the situations you mentioned?
Well, the process of the group for me was, I think, the best because, again, of the spirituality that was brought into it. I think that process was something that I really personally had to deal with. Through no fault of any churches, I was raised in a time period where if you did everything right, God was going to take good care of you. In today's world, we don't teach those kinds of teachings, but that's what I grew up with. And when things don't go right, you wonder what you've done wrong. So that when I was in the group and you would bring in things from philosophers or things concerning our souls or how our spirituality is tied into religion, or our spirituality is tied into our grief. That's not what I want to say. But I think the best thing I want to say is when you said that your soul doesn't grow until you've lost, or when you showed us the bush that was all bushy and the tree that was straight, and that pruning creates the bush. That was the first time that I had been able to look at grief through a healthy spiritual thought that made me realize this was just part of life. So the spirituality and the numerous examples like that was, for me, the biggest help. The other processes were the go-arounds, from person to person, to go around and talk about whatever it was that you had brought up. The readings were tremendously helpful. The retreat was extremely helpful. Every step, whatever steps I'm not bringing up, every step took me into another perspective, so that I feel real fast through the steps that you went through. I really wasn't sure I knew what they were, to learn all the truth. It was just the process that I was in that I didn't probably really realize I was in. Which I think is the healthy part of it, because sometimes I think when you get into, and I have nothing against 12-step programs, and I know something about them and I work with them, but sometimes I think you get too caught up in what is the next step, or am I in the step, and healing, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, where this was real natural.
Another question I'd like to ask you before then, the timing of this kind of group, for instance, if you knew someone in the community who had an immediate loss, would you recommend this kind of experience immediately after loss?
Yes, I really would. Because whether a person realizes it or not, I think to help yourself deal with the hurt, you get very hard. And you try real hard not to feel. And what this group would do is allow you to feel and allow you to cry. And I really have always believed that the best way to heal is to cry. But where do you go cry? And how crazy do you feel when you're driving down the street and you start to cry? And I have felt that. And that was because I was grieving. So to be able to go into a group and cry, especially from what I have seen in the people in the group that we're in, who have had immediate losses and are in a, there's no doubt that I would never go through what I went through, which was 10 years of trying to stuff it, because that's just that much longer of trying to bring it out, and not only bring out the grieving, but all the other things that you've done to yourself while you're trying to not really hurt.
You're right. We never expect to bury our children. And you're right, it doesn't end, it doesn't go away, and that's living with what we cannot fix. I mentioned this Monday why I like the image of a circle, because all of us today were on a retreat here and we drew our family circle, we would all have some bumps and bulges and patches, and that's what we go through with. We go through with losses that we can't fix. They mend and they heal over time, but they're never going to be.
He's not dealing with it. I mean, he won't even talk about it with his wife. He's just tough right now.
Yep. Any other comments about why we can't deal with things very well? We can't talk about it. Why we don't find places to talk about these incredible losses? And sometimes they're, to other people, wouldn't seem like they would be festering underneath, or they would be of the magnitude to cause problems. Any comments on that?
Well, mm-hmm. I know one of the things my daughter felt was that some of her friends and cousins who had little children after she lost her baby, they didn't want to bring them around because they thought it might make her feel bad. And so they would stay away, and she felt that came.
Again, it's the avoidance. In his case, he doesn't choose to talk about it because it's so painful, which isolates him in his own grief. And other people, oftentimes, this is that isolation theme, don't dare come around. If you've got a baby and your friend's lost a baby, you just feel like you're going to make them more miserable. So that happened to me in South Dakota when we'd had our two little boys, and my adopted mother's, who was a woman my mother's age in the congregation, her daughter's baby died in Minneapolis and then couldn't get pregnant again. And there I was, another pregnancy. And I had to deal with that. So I said, I don't know how to come over here anymore because I have three healthy children and your daughter can't. And we talked about it. I guess one of my things is it's much better to, in this case, come around and just say, you know, I have to just say that I'm feeling really awkward, and I feel like maybe I'm making you more miserable with my baby around. Could we talk about that? You know, that's what I think I would wish could happen, or in this case, whatever your relationship is, to somehow start to break through and say, do you want to talk? Could I be a person you could talk to, or is there some place? Because any way we can help people or help ourselves break out of isolation is the number one step, I think. Mm-hmm.
Norma, do you have men in your groups, or is that only women?
I have had two men. One was a man whose partner, they were not married, but his partner died of cancer, and his first wife had been injured or had an aneurysm or something, and so she's in one of our nursing homes and has not been respondent for 12 years. So he's got that sort of double loss. And we always encourage men to keep coming because we're so afraid they'll just stay away because they're the only one. But he would come and cry, just sob for 2 hours. It was very therapeutic for him. But now he's not coming anymore, and I've heard he's become very ill himself. The other man I have in the group is the father of this girl who committed suicide in our community in March. And he and his wife come to the group, and he has not missed a session. And he has told me, as well as his wife is, that he never thought he would come to something like this. But I think out of desperation and trying to find some answers, he's come and discovered it's just a wonderful thing to do. But the other answer to that is not very many men seem to find themselves coming to a group like this. I think it's much more women, and I have some reasons, opinions of why I think that is. Maybe some men here could speak to that.
I just wondered if you had any methods or means for helping men to speak, because
helping men?
I think that is one of the things that does damage year after year after year. My father was unable to talk to me as a little child when my mother died when I was very small. And he had such a hard time with the grief. He was only a young man. Of course, as I look back now, I realize he was very young. But he was unable to talk to his own child about that death for years and years. And he was in his 70s when he finally really told me how my mother died. And I think that sort of thing makes us all that much poorer,
right.
Makes the family struggle with the unknowns, mm-hmm. All the things that I never talked about.
You're right.
Men need to learn how to do that just as much as women, mm-hmm. But how do you do it?
Did any of the men here want to speak to that issue? Yeah.
I went to a Widowed and Information Count Wicks group, mm-hmm. in Tacoma, and I wasn't going to go, but this lady in my church kept urging me to go, and she pestered me enough, so I went. My wife had died, and I thought I could just do it all myself. And there was only one other guy that went, so he and I and quite a few women were in the group. But I think that maybe my attitude that I had, and it was really good for me. I mean, I just, the people around me, I thought, well, maybe they were tired of hearing my story. But the people in this group, they never, mm-hmm. tired of hearing my story. I mean, I listened also to their, own situations. It of course gave me the realization that I wasn't the only one, that which I would have thought if I would have been the only, not in the group.
But you went because a woman, another person encouraged you to come?
Yeah, I don't think I would have gone. I don't know why. It just, well, I was pretty busy with three kids. Mm-hmm. And so I just said, well, I couldn't, but it was one of the best things that I could have done, was to try to work some of that grief through. And this talk about crying, that was hard for me at first, and then I just said, to hell with it, if I feel like crying, I'm going to. Mm-hmm. And that gave me a lot of strength, mm-hmm. actually. I was a lot stronger. But my father, he didn't actually go for that, but that's too bad.
When my husband's brother was killed by this bolt of lightning and everything, we were in Colorado, so we had to drive home for 2 days steady across the prairies. And I did most of the driving because we had a station wagon, and he was laying in the back seat weeping for 2 days with my children, which was a wonderful thing to do. And he oftentimes talks about what a cleansing experience that was, because it was such immediate, fresh grief that what else can you do? And now his natural socialization and process, his own personality, everything else, he's a, i.e., typical male, I guess, in the sense that he didn't have permission to cry, a social permission to cry, I guess. And so now, when he feels this grief building up, it might be over Dave, it might be over somebody else, his expression is he'll go out and take a walk and try to work up a cry. and sometimes can do that. Sometimes goes to Dave's grave, and then it will come. And we have interesting conversations about that, because I cry over so many, I cry over everything. Like my kids say, you cry over everything. But I think that's a social difference that we have as male and female, and about the tears. I saw another hand back there about men. Did you want to say something?
Oh, you answered my that thought, because I feel that women can do more in giving men permission to cry than another man can give to another man.
Oh.
I really believe that, because men feel they have to, you know, stand up and be the strong one and all that, and women can cry on their shoulders and all that. Uh-huh. I wanted to ask you, too, how you felt as having to drive the car back then. Minnesota,
well. Oh, well, I cried and drove at the same time. No, I was, that was what I was happy to do, because my husband just needed to collapse, you know, and just, it was what I felt fine about it. I don't know how
to. Well, I grew up in a home where I never saw my dad cry.
Uh-huh.
And it was, you know, the macho thing. It was. And didn't have permission to do.
Oh no! I just wish my husband would cry. I said, "Come on, cry." You know, I think it's wonderful for everybody to cry, because I know how healing and therapeutic it is for me, and I believe it's a physiological release. You know, so yeah, I think it's great when men can cry. In answer to your question about how do you encourage men. I think it's an educational issue. Like in churches, one of the things, in any place you are, your workplace, the video tomorrow, there's a wonderful section in there on the two attorneys, Jerry, whose wife was dying, and then his attorney, who was a woman, goes to our church, who is one of these incredibly wonderful people. And every day that they'd come to work, they'd just sort of have a cup of coffee, and that was a male-female kind of thing on the workplace. Which is one of the issues I like to talk about, is what if you work with someone that you know is in grief? The tendency at work is to get to work, you know, or maybe it's 5 minutes over coffee, where I think this whole idea of general initiation is just to say, you know, I know what you're going, I know your situation, and I just want you to know that I'm here if you ever want to talk. That's a safety valve you can say to someone in the workplace. Another thing I think is helpful is in our church, I put on this series of called Living with Loss, and we had the two people you'll see tomorrow, plus another two, which I might show on Saturday if I have time, talking about what it was like to lose our first spouse, to become remarried, and to blend their families. And the place was packed, and you could have heard a pin drop as they willingly shared their story. And what I've had experienced, male and female, is when I've asked people if they would share their story, i.e. in a forum or to a group of people, I've never had a refusal yet, in the sense that I think my thought about that is that people want to share their story if they feel it will be received in a caring way, and it's not like they're just, you know, getting interviewed or something like that. And I think that's part of wanting community. And so I think on the church, to encourage forums where we can talk to one another about these kinds of issues is one place to educate. And I think the more men and women give each other permission, however you see that, the more we can bring it out and put it on the educational agenda, I think, in whatever setting we're in.
I think the church can give people permission to be angry, to help realize that part of their grief is anger. And
yes.
That anger itself is not sinful.
Yeah.
It's God's gift to us, but we need to use it or do something with it.
That was a nice lead into this little book. I found it up here in the bookstore, too. May I Hate God by Pierre Wolf. Speaking of anger, we only have about 5 minutes left. I just want to quickly highlight some of the things I brought, and then we'll have some more discussion if we have time. This is one book, speaking of putting it on the educational agenda. I trained 5 people in June in our community who are going to lead a book discussion group in their own parish on this book. This is the book I use. Oh, this is one of my favorite Snoopy cartoons. To lead this in their own parish. And I should have told the bookstore people to order 100 copies of this book.
I found a couple more.
Oh, did you?
So there's
two more in there. But I found this here at Holden last year, and I just promote it to everybody. It's just an absolutely wonderful book. And if you know anybody in your church that's skilled at group leadership, all you really have to know how to do is to help facilitate a good discussion, and this book takes care of itself. And I would recommend this for anybody in any men's, women's, whatever age group, because it's each chapter in here is on a different kind of loss. And then at the end is what to say, what not to say. It's wonderful. It's called Helping People Through Grief by Dolores Canning. It's out of Bethany House Publishers. I'll leave that up here. Couple other things in terms of resources. I have a whole bunch of newsletters here. If any of you happen to be interested in this topic, I'll just leave them up here. Suicide survivors, all kinds of grief newsletters and that kind of thing that can be very helpful to people to hear other people's stories. Another thing I love to do is to teach children these kinds of issues, and to, for those of you who like to give books to grandchildren, children for birthday parties or whatever like that. This is one, I'm sure most of you know about this book, The Fall of Freddie the Leaf by Leo Buscaglia. And if you teach Sunday school or like when I go into to classrooms where the teacher may have died or something like that, I read this book. This does not have any religious teaching, but you can add whatever spirituality in a Sunday school setting to this one. It's about the natural rhythms of life and death in nature. And this is the book, It Must Hurt a Lot by Doris Sanford. And when I read this book to children or to adults, it's got these wonderful secrets. This could be, well, probably have time to do this on Saturday session. And then what I'll do is I buy things like this. Let's see, this is image. This is symbol and image, I think. So when you've had this experience of reading a book, and then I leave this with the teacher, or if the teacher has died, I'll leave this with the substitute teacher, the new teacher, and it's a symbol to remind them of their teacher, and then they buy the book kind of thing. This is a wonderful resource called Thumpy's Story of Love and Grief Shared. It's out of St. Joseph's Hospital in Springfield, Illinois, and it's got a coloring book and a, so if you wanted to ever kind of do this stuff in Christian education, and just think if you're at all involved in that kind of thing in your churches, just think of, if you know there's been a death in the parish or there's something very sad that's happened, I think it needs to be talked about. Right before we came out here, a week before, it was just awful. The phone rang at 4 a.m, and we woke up, and I could hear the sheriff's voice on the other end. He says, "Are you, my husband's a pastor," and he said, "You the pastor of First Lutheran Church?" And he said, "Yes." And he said, "Well, there's been a death in your congregation. Could you please come over to the home?" And it was just almost like getting the news that it was our own son, and it was a 19-year-old in our congregation who had been killed in a car accident. And I said, "Oh no, Peter, who is it?" And he said, "It's Joe Beavers." And Joe Beavers has just finished his freshman year at St. Olaf College. And the triple whammy grief is that his parents were divorced 3 years ago, and they had lost their other son when he was only three a few years back. Now that has impacted a tremendous lot of people in our congregation. So what I would advocate is that can be talked about. Joe taught kids in Sunday school. My children knew who he was, and the funeral was just overflowing with young kids. You know, so let's talk about that. Let's process, what does this mean for our faith? What does it mean about our beliefs about eternal life? So I guess whatever space you find yourself in, there are resources available to deal with that, and several other wonderful books I'd recommend. I read some liberation theologians. This is Gustavo Gutierrez on Job, God Talk, and the Suffering of the Innocent. This is just a wonderful book. And some of the teachings I do in the group is when we have spirituality after the coffee break. Usually we deal with whatever the theme of this book is, and then I'll do a handout on an 8x10 sheet of paper and like take quotes from something like this. And this has a lot to do, we are connected with all peoples, and the suffering of people in Central America has a lot to do with our suffering. So another book, Growing Strong at Broken Places by Paula Ripple. Several of them, in case you're interested, you can come up here and poke through them. It's almost time to quit, so I have another hour that I thought I could get into this hour. I'm always back a day. Any other things you'd like to talk about before we wrap it up?
Are there a lot of congregations that do have these groups for the green?
No. There are not a lot of congregations that do. How many of you here have a grief support group in your congregation? Okay, I see one hand, two hands, three. And I think that's several reasons. Partly because churches aren't large enough to have a big enough staff to have someone that could specialize in that. Or the staff members you do have, they probably don't feel that that's their particular gift or calling or whatever. Also because I think in church, we sometimes find it's the most difficult place to come. People that are in real severe grief, fresh grief or whatever, it's hard to come to church. You can't sing, you don't feel like singing. You feel like crying a lot, you're scared you're gonna cry. And see, I say, why can't we cry in church? That's what Barbara says on another piece of this section. She says, I wish that I could go to this group and then go worship. You know? So there are a lot of reasons, and we look at what we do, and we get, we sort of dress, we don't at Holden. I mean, back home, most of us sort of wear our Sunday best, and you think about what we do when we go to church. And I remember when Joyce, my good friend, was killed, and I just moved to Duluth, and I didn't know anybody, and I was just devastated. My first friend was killed, and I just felt for a number of Sundays like I couldn't be in coffee hour. You know, I just wanted to cry in coffee hour, and I'm sure a lot of you have felt that way too. So there are a lot of reasons why I think the church needs to deal with that. And yet, on the other hand, I find people that are devout, church-going folks, etc., that find more freedom in this setting, in the funeral home setting, to talk about their spirituality than they ever do in a Bible study group or wherever else. And another one of my strong opinions about that is that, I said this on Monday too, that unless the group is set up for the purpose of talking about your grief and loss issues, it tends, there's not the agenda for that in any other group in the church, as I've experienced it. Yeah.
How do you draw in some of the traditional sources in your workshops and imaging, like Granger Westberg, Good Grief, or Elizabeth Kubler Ross? Find that those come a little later in the process?
Well, I'm not a real systematic person, but what I will do is do a little bit on stages of grief and loss, like Elizabeth Kubler Ross. But what I find is that Joe said it, I think, the best. He's the one whose daughter committed suicide in March, and he said, I don't really care about stages, and I don't care about that right now. I just need love. And a lot of what people find in a sharing process group like this is that different things will meet them at different times, and who knows what it will be. So I don't have any sort of like, 101, 103 kind of sequential necessarily, Yeah.
I was going to say one of the reasons that men are so unexpressive about their grief or unable to cry is that it starts as young boys.
Yes.
When you get knocked down on the playground.
Sure does.
Either taunted or you're told not to be a crybaby.
Yes, definitely.
And that you grow up and you go off into combat and come back and 20, 25 years later, it's still unresolved.
That's right.
I worked with a group of, by the nature of the job, there was a heavy concentration of combat veterans of the Korean War and Vietnam War. And many of the Korean vets have spent 20 years as alcoholics because there was nobody to talk to, nobody to bring it up with. And the same thing with the Viet vets. And their grief went into destructive activities because there was no place to take it.
Exactly.
In part because they were not allowed to cry or to fall.
I have another interesting slant on that. One of the schools I went to was in Cotton, Minnesota, which is up on the Iron Range. I could hardly find the school. And a teacher had died, age 63 or something, of I don't know what, but she was there on Monday and she died, and the funeral was on the next Monday. So I was asked to come in. Well, this teacher had a first, second, and third grade, and kindergarten, I think, but she was a reading teacher. So they wanted me to go to each class and tell each class separately and not blend them together. And it was an interesting study in exactly what you're talking about, because when I read this book to them, and then left the heart and all that kind of thing, and I said to them, do you know that it's really good to cry? And they all go, I'd love to teach that age because they just think everything you say is wonderful. Their eyes are just bugging out of me. And I said, that I told them about my husband losing his brother. Now it was good for him to cry. And I said, I bet a lot of your dads would like to cry, but they don't know how. And they were, went to the next class and they were just a little less willing to believe that was true. By the time I got to third grade, I said, do you know that it is really good for men to be able to cry? Men and women. I said, how many of you think that it's okay for boys to cry? And the boys are rolling their eyes and snickering at me. And it was like, who is this woman? Get her out of here. Men don't cry. My dad doesn't want to cry. But it was real interesting to see that progression that was real firm in boys' minds by third grade, and the kindergartners were willing to maybe believe that was true. You know, and the girls in third grade were a little more sophisticated too, and they said, you know, poking the boys and saying, yes it is, and my dad likes to cry sometimes, and so yeah, we grew up with some pretty strong social taboos about that. Anything else? Well, thank you for coming.